When the doctor does your blood sugar curves to determine whether you're a diabetic, he will note a number of things. Number one, that after you've eaten, your blood sugar may go up a variable amount during the first 2 hours. But although the rise differs depending whose blood sugar is taken, the drop down at any hour after 2 hours is never much below the starting point at fasting. What really brings that starting point down is having something like mashed potatoes or rolled oats at breakfast time, since the fine starchy material is absorbed and the body says, oh my goodness, we've got a real sudden flood of carbohydrates in the bloodstream and we need insulin to open up the cells and get that sugar into the body cells right away quick for energy's sake. This happens and the blood sugar drops below the fasting level. So one of the worst things for a person to have in the morning is either mashed potatoes or something like rolled oats, unless they spiked it with protein powder. In diabetics, the fasting blood sugar is higher to start with, the curve goes up higher, and it lasts longer. The severe diabetic can start with a fasting sugar of 200, that's milligrams per 100 mil. It can go up as high as 300 and stay there from the third to fourth hour, only dropping down to maybe 265, 6 hours after the meal was eaten. You can see, therefore, that it is not too difficult to diagnose diabetes from a blood sugar test. Let's look now at the pancreas that secretes insulin, which, as you know by now, opens the cell membranes and allows glucose to enter these cells for energy production. There are two main types of tissue in the pancreas. The first one is called the acini type, and it secretes enzymes into the duodenum for digestion and also secretes alkaline salts at a level of about 1,200 to 1,500 mils per day. So that's up to 1.5 liters a day, which is a pretty good secretion level for digestion. Then you have the islets of Langerhans. These amount to 1 to 2% of the total pancreatic tissue only. In humans, there are two kinds of cells in the islets. A, the beta cells, which produce insulin and represent about 50 to 75% of the islet cells. And B, alpha cells. Now, the alpha cells, a lot of people haven't heard of, but they're the ones that secrete glucagon. And this is a hormone secreted in response to low blood sugar or stimulation by the growth hormone. This particular hormone, glucagon, is called hyperglycemic glycogenolytic factor, if you like long names. At diabetic autopsy, beta cells, the ones that secrete your insulin, are seen to have degenerated over the years. High blood sugars for several days lead to beta cell hypertrophy. Also, beta cells are often present in severe diabetics, but are degenerated with hyalin. And that's a material that looks like plastic. They contain no secretory granules. It's been estimated that the Western pancreas is overloaded by a factor of some 600% by simple carbohydrates. White flour, white sugar, and so on. Okay? It is rather interesting to note that if the whole pancreas is removed, as a treatment for cancer, for example, patients rarely require more than 40 units of insulin per day. But many diabetics require more, some more than 200 units of insulin per day. This, of course, indicates that our poor pancreas has been working very, very hard in an effort to try and control blood sugar in the diabetic particularly when that diabetic is a serious one, or, as we say, uncontrolled. Until 1921, the diagnosis of diabetes was a death sentence. In Alberta, it was still considered a death sentence until the early 1930s. Some studies have indicated that 14% of diabetics are hospitalized on an average of 6 weeks per year. And this is because of poor control of blood sugars. This leads, as we've indicated, to a 12 times risk of kidney disease, 17 times the risk of limb gangrene, depending on what studies you read, 80% of limb amputations being in diabetic patients, and diabetes is the leading cause of blindness in our society. In some diabetics, gangrene will show particularly first in the big toe. If it is what they call wet gangrene, the doctors will immediately take the leg off somewhere between the knee and the hip. This speaker wants to indicate a protection for that kind of amputation. If you have wet gangrene, or any gangrene of a toe, taking broad-spectrum food-based selenium with vitamin E will prevent the amputation of that leg. Dr. Shute, world famous and considered Dr. Vitamin E in Europe, operated in Ontario, Canada, and personally showed the speaker pictures that he had taken of gangrenous toes and feet that normally would have been amputated when his patients called him in. Other specialists said, if you're having that quack, we're not going to look after you anymore and we'll wipe our hands of you. Walked out on the patient, and I specifically remember him showing me an elderly lady who was to have her leg amputated, who was put on a broad-spectrum food-based vitamin E, who, in a matter of weeks after that, she'd noticed a red line had occurred around the base of the toe, separating her normal-looking tissue from this coal-black toe, and had gotten loose at this red line. I have seen the pictures where this dear soul, with her face squirming, has taken a pair of tweezers, grabbed the toenail, and it came loose off of her foot, and leaving a nice pink area underneath with no evidence of gangrene. And this woman, instead of having to be fit for an artificial leg and learning to walk on it, was capable of walking for the rest of her lifetime, but also continued to take the vitamin E. When it comes to vitamin E, I have to give you some warnings. Number one, if you have congestive heart failure or swelling ankles and you have never been on vitamin E, you can only take 150 international units safely. If you go above that, you may be one of those who gets a heart that has been pushed too much, and you can die in approximately 10 days. When you've taken vitamin E for a period of time at the low level of 150 international units, and your blood pressure has slowly snuck down, which it will do in about one-third of cases, one-third it won't raise the blood pressure at all, and one-third it actually immediately starts to lowering it, then if you notice too that your heart congestion or enlarged heart from chest x-ray is now decreased, or your ankles no longer swell, you are free to increase the vitamin E to 400 international units or higher. Do not go above 3 a day if you are under about 165 pounds, and that's 3 of the 400 international units, since a food-based vitamin E above this level will depress the immune system or exhaust it. So, what am I saying? I'm saying that vitamin E can raise high blood pressure, in 1/3 of those people who take it. And in my experience, this blood pressure slowly comes down again. Or it can have no effect on blood pressure levels whatsoever. But in 1/3 of cases, it's been our joy to notice that it will decrease blood pressure. So keep those factors in mind when utilizing vitamin E, and you will have good results. And for heaven's sake, whatever you do, start your vitamin E before you get the gangrene in the foot. Basically, there are three methods for the treatment of diabetes. Number one is diet. For the obese or overweight, your diet should be about 25 calories per kilogram of ideal body weight. If you're an ideal weight already, you can go to 35 calories per kilogram, and if you're a thin diabetic, 45 calories per kilogram. Because Smith and his associates in Chicago and in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition have well shown that certified organically grown foods have 300 to 400% more nutrition in them than the readily commercially available ones do, one should ensure that they are eating this type of produce, since you may eat less and get more nutrition. Also, you should not forget the fact that you were at least born with teeth, whether you have them now or not, but whatever you have there, you should be either chewing or gumming for long periods of time, sufficient to let your salivary glands do the work that they were intended to do. In Canada, it is presently recommended that our protein should be 25%, our fat should be 30%, and our carbohydrates 45%. I object to this, since that fat level is far too high for the average individual or the diabetic. Certainly for the sedentary type of lifestyle that we have now. 40% of the elderly onset diabetics can be controlled by diet alone. Obese patients rarely require insulin, so their diabetic control means diet plus weight loss, diet plus insulin, or diet plus oral hypoglycemics, meaning the various pills they take. Note here that when I've quoted this, I've taken this from medical journals, and no mention in this particular medical article was made of supplements or herbs, which we will tell you about later. A steady loss of sugar in the urine is often partly compensated for by an increase of what we call gluconeogenesis, which means simply the new generation of sugar. This occurs using protein in the tissue or from the proteins in the tissue and leads to an increase of nitrogen in the urine, since nitrogen is in protein. What does this result in? It results in muscle wasting and is a feature we find in severe diabetics. Exercise must be regular. It increases insulin binding and increases the ability of muscles to take up glucose. The reason exercise should be regular is because the benefit can be lost in 48 hours of non-exercise, and it results in a 20% decrease in diabetic control, regardless of your muscle size. And that was noted in the Montreal meeting of the Canadian Society for Clinical Investigation. Although exercise is a bad word in today's society, it is important even in older patients, because as age increases, blood sugar and triglyceride levels do also in many people. Most diabetics on insulin keep in best health if A, their weight is slightly below standard, and B, your calorie intake is also slightly below standard, and that you'll find is a little harder. Well, let's have a look at vegetarianism and diabetes. In a 21-year follow-up of 25,698 cases, which were white, and they were Seventh-day Adventists, aged 30 to 89 years, The incidence of diabetes was only 45% of the usual. As their intake of meat increased, so did their incidence of diabetes, and this occurred more in males than females, probably because males tend to eat more meat than females do amongst the Seventh-day Adventists. However, the whole thing may partly be related to what was eaten in place of the meat. For example, legumes, or beans, peas, and lentils, will lead to a low and slow rise in blood sugar. They also lead to lower cholesterol and lower triglycerides. I'm not like the name of the reference here, although I suspect I would have changed my name, but that was the two men that were into that particular study were Jenkins and Crapple. Looking at carbohydrates, one key here is to cook less. Williams of Guy's Hospital in London tested normals on cooked versus raw carbohydrates. What did he find? Well, he found that the blood sugars increased 3 times on cooked versus raw. That's a tremendous key indicating that the diabetic should really concentrate on raw vegetables. No wonder a 60% intake of raw vegetables at a meal has a significant effect on treating diabetes. Insulin increased more than 2 times, or 200%, on cooked starch, therefore greatly taxing these little islets that were secreting insulin. As we've mentioned before, mashed potatoes were very bad for diabetics, as small starch particles are rapidly absorbed from the gut, leading to increased blood sugar and insulin requirements. Next, of course, is the fact that complex carbohydrates are better by far, but vary as to their ability to increase blood sugar. And this is called glycemic index. In other words, you can eat the same volume of a particular food and it will not cause as much of an increase in blood sugar as the identical volume of a different food. Of the 4 main starches eaten in Canada, and I'm going to start at the worst and going to the best, and these starches are 4, potatoes, 3, corn, 2, whole wheat bread, 1, rice, brown rice, which is the best for diabetes. Remember that type 1 diabetes was rare in the Chinese, and these, of course, are our rice eaters. While we're talking about factors that treat diabetes, here's an article indicating that the scientists at the University of Toronto and St. Michael's Hospital have discovered that taking American ginseng before a meal can reduce a person's blood sugar. They state bluntly that the findings suggest that ginseng may be useful in both managing and preventing the disease. Those with diabetes who took the ginseng, whether it was before or during their meal, saw a 20% drop in their blood sugar levels compared with when they were fed placebos in place of the ginseng. For those who are not diabetic, the same reduction was experienced only when the ginseng was taken 40 minutes before their meal. So if you had diabetics in your family, but you are not yet a diabetic, or you had large babies when they were born, and you're still not yet a diabetic, take your ginseng 40 minutes before a meal. Studies out of Harvard found that if you change your food and your intake of ginseng, that they had confirmed these results. Another significant part of the studies found that ginseng taken alone does not lower blood sugar levels. It has its effect only when taken with or followed by food. So a factor, or a big quote, that this writer or speaker is going to say is the following, quote, "All diabetics should be on legumes. Those are beans, peas, and lentils of every description. Another fiber that is good for treatment of diabetes is pectin, And here's a study regarding pectin. Pectin, which is two apples, and they put in a skim milkshake. And if you do that, I will tell you right now, since we've already discovered that cancer is higher in diabetics, do not use cow's milk, use goat's milk. But two apples in skim milkshake, that's goat milkshake, consumed 10 minutes before a meal of meat, brown rice, cheese, and bread, and the cheese is a mistake, what were the results? 35% less insulin was required to return blood sugars to normal. It would have, that's from the Diabetes and Metabolism Journal. And if they had cut out the cheese, made sure it was whole bread, whole wheat bread, and brown rice, they'd have even gotten better results. There are some other interesting results with respect to the treatment of diabetes. When psyllium was given, which incidentally is a wonderful factor in solving both diarrhea and constipation if you have the right type. But when it was given at 2 packets weighing 3.4 milligrams each and mixed in water to the diabetics and given immediately before breakfast and before dinner, I guess that they mean by supper at in our terminology in Canada, what were the results? Well, their after eating glucose peaks were reduced 14% at breakfast and 20% at supper time. These results were relative to controls who were placed on placebos. And you can find that study in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. What also decreases insulin where it is high is biotin, generally classified as a B vitamin and found high in soya beans, there's your fiber again, rice bran, there's your low glycemic index again, range eggs, and walnuts in that order, but found to be very high in brewer's yeast. Biotin is synergistic with insulin, and although diabetic biotin levels are usually high, it appears not to be available in the diabetic, but it definitely helps them when given as a supplement. It has been found that broad-spectrum vitamin C containing bioflavonoids protects blood vessels, and you also may or may not remember that bioflavonoids used to be called vitamin P for permeability since they closed down the oversized pores in capillary walls. There's a warning for the diabetic. Narrow-spectrum ascorbic acid or vitamin C, which is put out by the ton in North America per year, is oxidized in humans to produce two compounds. First one is dehydroascorbic acid, and the second one is dehydroisoascorbic acid. Both the dehydroascorbic acid and dehydroisoascorbic acid are diabetic generators. As they say in medical language, diabetogenic. In other words, they will generate diabetes. And diabetics have an elevation of both dehydroascorbic acid and dehydroisoascorbic acid anyway. These two substances also break capillary wall linings and causes bleeding. Part of the reason why a diabetic will have a greater chance for stroke than others. Ascorbic acid will lower cholesterol levels in 60% of diabetic cases by at least 40% on only 500 milligrams per day. But remember to take your ascorbic acid in the broad spectrum vegetation source. Another vitamin that has been found very effective, not only in the literature but also in this speaker's experience, has been that of a broad-spectrum vitamin E. And this vitamin will tend to reduce insulin requirements quite rapidly in some people, and for this reason should be started at 100 international units daily only and increased slowly so that the patient may adjust the insulin accordingly. This can be found in the Annals of New York Academy of Science as early as 1949, the Annals of New York Academy of Science in a publication on the effect of vitamin E in diabetics gave a warning, stating that diabetics on insulin should be started on 100 international units or less daily of the vitamin E, and the dosage raised slowly to permit the adjustment of the insulin dose. In the same publication, in 1982, Lubin and Macklin pointed out that it was necessary for the diabetic, or advisable, to take vitamin E, since the diabetic appeared to have an increased requirement for this particular vitamin. In 1986, in the Annals of Nutrition and Metabolism, it was pointed out here that supplementation of this vitamin could reduce the risk of developing diabetes. In the journal Prostaglandins, Leukotrienes, Essential Fatty Acids, there was an article pointing out that vitamin E was a favorable adjunct to treatment because it was effective in reversing abnormal platelet aggregation and because, too, it was relatively non-toxic. In the Journal of Diabetes, 1988, in 4 weeks, it noticed that in the type 1 diabetic, which is the very serious juvenile type, which tends to shorten life expectancy, that a vitamin E at 400 international units taken daily decreased platelet thromboxane. Again, meaning that platelet aggregation was reduced, so that it had less chance of forming clots. They suggested, therefore, that vitamin E treatment might be promising for the prevention of diabetic angiopathy, meaning disease in your diabetic blood vessels. The same was found in what they called a double-blind crossover study for type 1 diabetics, giving them 1 gram of vitamin E daily or a placebo. And after 35 days, the supplemented group were found to have a decrease in their platelet aggregation. In other words, they had less chance of forming the dreaded clots. That was found in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, at least published by them in 1988. Way back in 1953, in the Clinical Medical Journal, patients with gangrene of the toes that we've talked about had excellent results, just taking 100 to 150 milligrams of vitamin E orally 3 times a day. And this was strongly recommended by the author to be used in the cases of people with gangrene of the feet. That was in Clinical Medicine Journal. I could go on quoting more. However, the only reason for quoting these in the first place is the fact that the most recent peer-reviewed medical post publication carried a fairly lengthy article in which it was said that vitamin E had virtually no beneficial effects in prevention or treatment of diabetics. It was significant to the speaker that the vitamin E is not described as to whether it is synthetic or food-based. I might say that a high percentage of the synthetic DL vitamin E is produced from terpol, the same stuff that turpentine is made from, and I don't think the designer of this glorious body had in mind that we should be busy swallowing paint thinners on a regular basis. In the journal called Prostaglandins, Leukotrienes, Essential Fatty Acids, and in the journal called Diabetes, we also note that vitamin E was beneficial in reducing the risk for angina, and it alleviated the severity of intermittent claudication. We have seen this over and over again. Claudication as those terrible leg cramps you get when you're attempting to walk too fast or run too long, and you have to stop for the cramps to go away. A serious leg ulceration in diabetes is called necrobiosis lipodica diabeticorum because it is yellow in color. Block, in Clinical Medical Journal, notes a woman with 3 of these ulcers having been present for 1 year. On vitamin E, those 3 ulcers were gone in 3 weeks. Now, selenium E would be better, since selenium and E are synergistic. And we must note here that one thing that is really bad, and this is also not brought up in the articles, quote, against vitamin E, is the fact that if a certain number of your patients are female and are on the birth control pills, you wipe out the ability of vitamin E to be effective. So unless the study tells me how many people are women, how many of those women are on the birth control pill, the study really isn't that significant. Other than if you get some effects, which means, of course, that what you gave them had greater power than the blocking effect of the birth control pill or whatever. Same thing applies to people taking iron pills, and many women are taking iron pills because their periods are too high. It has also been found that alfalfa lowers blood sugar, and we do have alfalfa-based supplements available nowadays. Vanadium decreases blood sugar. If adequate, the usual heart problems in diabetics are not seen, and diabetic cataracts are much decreased. When it comes to vanadium, the sources are rather interesting. In 100 milligrams of the food listed below, we will give you the amount of vanadium in micrograms, starting at the most and proceeding down. Buckwheat was 100, parsley was 80, soya bean was 70, egg was 42, oats was 35, but as noted before, oats are not recommended because of their effect on inducing high demand for insulin. Corn, 15, and green beans, 14. When you look at the buckwheat, the parsley, and the soya bean being the three top ones, you'll notice a vegetable predominant. At the University of Alberta, Harish and G did a study incorporating barley bread products in the diet of non-insulin dependent diabetics. In other words, these were diabetics that could get along with maybe a pill or severe diet and lifestyle change. The average barley bread intake was 6.3 exchanges per day for males and 4.7 for females. This equated to 53.3 grams per day for males and 40.1 grams per day for females. This corresponds to approximately 2 ounces or less per day, which isn't that much. But the barley bread intake resulted in a decrease of fasting insulin for males of 24% in 3 months' time and 23% in 6 months' time. It was interesting to note that the diastolic, or the low blood pressure reading, in those same males during that 6 months had dropped 9%. The patients also noted a decrease in hunger pangs. I should be on that myself. Mid-AM and mid-afternoon. Initially, the carbohydrate intake of the male subjects was 52%. The protein intake was stable at 19%, and the fat was what this speaker considers too high at 29%. In the last 3 months of the 6 month period, it was noted that vitamin B2, folate, vitamin C, calcium, and zinc decreased, and the greatest fall was in folic acid at 6 months' time. A significant factor here is that with the B2 and the folate and the vitamin C and the calcium and the zinc decreasing at the same time that the blood sugar was decreasing and the blood pressure and so on was decreasing, that it would be advisable for these people to be on a vitamin mineral supplement containing these products, provided they were organically food-based products they were put on. Both barley buns and bread were used, and their taste gave a score of 6.6 out of 7, which is pretty good. And the buns, 6.2 out of 7 by the male subjects. So they preferred the bread at 6.6 out of 7 for the taste. The females ate from none to 5.3 slices per day with an average of 2.6. Their carbohydrate, protein, and fat intake for the 6 months were 55% for the carbohydrates, 17% for proteins, and 28% for the fats. During the study, female subjects consumed an average of 40.1 grams per day of barley, which is less than 2 ounces, as you know. In the females, intakes of vitamin B2 and total folate decreased, while vitamin C, calcium, and zinc remained stable. So it appears as if the females need the B complex more than they did the vitamin mineral supplements containing B complex that the males need. Since both groups felt satiated or satisfied, overweight people would find it easier to approach normal weight. The subject's meal plan utilized 8 slices per day. The bread was 50% barley flour and assembled as 33% flour and 17% cracked barley. And that means that was 33% barley flour and 17% cracked barley, which was soaked afterwards, and that was the proportion of the flour. The rest would have been better at whole wheat. If you remember about our HbA1c hemoglobin test that gave the doctor the idea of whether or not a person's blood sugar levels had been controlled within the normal range for a few days, that particular level in the females dropped from 6.9 from the day they started to 6.48% in 3 months and 6.16 at 6 months. However, the serum insulin values dropped from 9.5% at the start to 5% at 3 months and were lower than 5 at 6 months, but not much lower. During the study period, the barley provided about 35% of the dietary fiber intake. In all subjects, male or female, the hemoglobin A1C dropped, indicating much better control of the diabetes. The results were even greater in the male subjects compared to the female. This study demonstrated that barley has a high level of beta-glucan, which is a soluble fiber, and is effective in decreasing blood sugars and blood fats. The average bread consumption per capita per year in this society is 65.2 kilograms, which is far too much if it happens to be that white wallpaper paste that has a brown crust on it called white bread. Another factor that's really important for the treatment of serious diabetics particularly is an amino acid called taurine, which was found initially in beef heart and therefore called Taurus or Taurus the bull. This amino acid at 50 milligrams per day acts similarly to insulin. It also is a treatment for retinal problems, which are common in diabetics. However, taurine should never be taken on a regular basis, because the body then gets fooled thinking that all it's doing is getting a hold of a meal of beef heart. It's interesting to note that in order to prevent this, you will take the taurine, say, at 25 milligrams twice a day for 2 days, then you'll go off 1 day, then take 25 the next day, and then the next day after take 2 a day, and then go off. It varies a lot as long as you are not taking it 50 milligrams day after day. You must have a break once in a while. Now, sucrose, or common table sugar, is felt to be responsible for 10% of diabetes and leads to retinopathy, or disease of your retina, even if the sugar is taken with a high-fiber, low-fat diet. That you will discover in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Since sorbitol, and I remind you to read labels, tends to concentrate in the lens, leading to cataracts, and also in the back of the eye, leading to retinopathy, be sure you read your labels so that you will not be consuming foods sweetened with sorbitol. And also, look for the word sorbate and avoid that as well. Quercetin is another factor that leads to a decrease of sorbitol accumulation in the lens. And consequently, an intake of quercetin will give you longer time if you're a diabetic without cataracts, because the onset of cataracts is delayed where the quercetin levels are high. Where is quercetin found? It's found in the outer layers of onions and in apple peels. So people who peel everything off, a little bit of harder chewing outer layer of the onion, and take the peels off, are not getting their quercetin. Fructose, which is another sugar you can get, is taken up more slowly and therefore produces less stress on the islet in the pancreas because of a more gradual demand for insulin. It is sweeter, so less may be used. Fructose, however, comes with a warning. Fructose can induce copper deficiency, which can make diabetics worse. It is therefore vital that the diabetic that has fructose is taking copper in some form or another. It is available in a thorn product called copper citrate. It's also available in Brazil nuts, soya lecithin, but remember that lecithin is very high in phosphorus, so you need to balance it with your calcium magnesium. And if you have any form of constipation, you can take 4 calcium magnesiums a day, if not 3. And it's also fairly high in almonds with the skin. When fructose is used as a short-term replacement for other carbohydrates, it is normally found that diabetic control improves. In this writer's experience, he has been favored with contact with aboriginals who, having found they had diabetes, began to treat themselves in part, and it was noted that they had fairly good control of the disease as a result of eating yarrow leaves. Unfortunately, in diabetics, a condition called retinopathy, or disease of the retina, occurs in a high percentage. Diabetes with this condition, namely retinopathy, are found to be low in magnesium. And if you recall that bioflavonoids, such as in acerola or rosehips, prevents oxidation of ascorbic acid to dehydroascorbic acid, which in turn leads to the breakdown of capillary walls, then note that bioflavonoids prevent this breakdown and the associated bruising we sometimes see in the arms of the diabetic and elderly populations.